Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending. With real-time notifications, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. And parents can rest easy, knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
But yeah, you know, you really need to put your ego aside because there are no credits on the front or the back. You never hear, you know, when a segment goes well, it's like, oh my God, that Rock segment was awesome, or that, you know, Jericho segment was awesome. They don't say like, oh, the blank name of the writer segment really killed it. When a segment goes south, you know, whether, I mean, there's the online reaction, of course, but even internally, it's like Vince wants to see you at gorilla position, you know, the backstage area right before you go through the curtain. You know, occasionally the talent too, but there's a lot of pressure on you to deliver because you're only as good as your last show. So you really don't have the ability to be like riding high. There's so many times I could point out like the high of a previous show and then failing spectacularly the next week.
Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producer is Patrick Antonetti. I was very excited to have this guest on the podcast, and the conversation was terrific. I really enjoyed it. I hope you do as well. Brian Gewirtz is a senior vice president of development at 7 Bucks Productions. That's the production company co-founded by Dwayne Johnson, obviously probably more well-known as The Rock, and his producing partner, Danny Garcia. And Brian Gewirtz was a WWE writer from 1999 to 2015, and a head writer at that company. He has written a new book, There's Just One Problem, True Tales from the Former, One-Time, Seventh Most Powerful Person in WWE. And it gives great insight into what his job was, and it was a fascinating one for sure. It's very honest. It's certainly not burying the WWE, but he does take you behind the scenes and give you just great insight into some of the rivalries that existed, some of the most famous things that we saw on screen. Again, Brian wrote for years for The Rock. He wrote for Roddy Piper. He wrote for Kurt Angle. I mean, he got sort of current to the point where he did do some stuff for Becky Lynch. He has had a very, very interesting career. And prior to his WWE work, he worked as a sitcom writer, including for a Jenny McCarthy show called Jenny, and Nancy Travis, and some other stuff. So we had a really, really great conversation, got into a lot of stuff, including the skills and temperament one needs to write for a professional wrestling company, what it was like for Brian to write for people who were obviously very different than him. You know, Brian is indeed not The Rock, though he wrote for The Rock and Kurt Angle and others. Talked about Vince McMahon's departure from WWE over alleged sexual misconduct and what that will mean for the company. Why Brian wanted to write the book. Brian worked on the original XFL product, which was, just to be blunt, a shit show. And just a number of other things. It's a little under an hour. Again, I know everybody's not a wrestling fan, and I understand that, but this is not just sort of storyline and stuff like that. It gets into just an interesting, crazy kind of role, and that is someone who writes professional wrestling for the most famous professional wrestling company out there. So much appreciate Brian Gewirtz. I wish him the best of luck with his book. And without further ado, Brian Gewirtz, Senior Vice President of Development at 7 Bucks Productions and the former head writer for the WWE. All right. As I said at the top, I have been looking forward to this interview for a long time because I find what our guest has done in the past and even what he's doing currently really, really fascinating. Brian Gewirtz is an executive producer for NBC's Young Rock as part of his role as a senior vice president of development at Seven Bucks Productions. That is the production company co-founded by Dwayne Johnson and his producing partner, Danny Garcia. He is here on this podcast as the author of There's Just One Problem, True Tales from the Former One-Time Seventh Most Powerful Person in WWE. Though the title of that book obviously is self-deprecating, Brian Gewirtz is a former head writer for the WWE, worked as a writer for that company from 1999 to 2015, has had incredible influence, if you were a pro wrestling fan at that time, of so many of the most famous things that you saw on the WWE airwaves. And as I've said on this podcast many times, like, writing for professional wrestling, at least in my opinion, it's a fascinating sort of subgenre of writing itself. And also, if you understand professional wrestling and its tropes, I think you honestly have an upper hand on understanding the state of politics in America in 2022. And with that, I bring in Brian Gewirtz. Welcome to the Sports Media Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. This is a great ramp up. I'm very, very happy to be here and talking. And as you know, as well known, you know, the book coming out tomorrow or on Tuesday, the 16th. But my Mets are in first place and they're doing like very, very un-Mets-like things. So I'm a little, you know, just this whole week has been just very overwhelming.
Yeah, these are the salad days from Brian Gewirtz. The Mets are in first place. The Bills are a preseason Super Bowl favorite. You have a book coming out. And again, Brian, coming on this podcast, which I believe will be your 74th podcast that you've done since the book promotion has come, I'm going to try to do my best to ask you a couple different questions than the previous ones that you've did. I watched the Ariel Helwani podcast. I thought that was really, really interesting. He obviously is a very, very big wrestling fan. But we'll try to go a little, I think, on this podcast, a little more process for you, just to sort of change it up a little bit and less sort of some of the famous storylines that you were part of. So let's start here. What are the skills and temperament one needs to write for a professional wrestling company?
I would say you really, it's very, very important to not have an ego. And it's clear from the outset, because unlike any other television show. And by the way, this is the daily reminder of the 74 podcast. New York City police sirens and or fire trucks have
awesome. Yeah, we love Nat Sound on this podcast. I lived in New York City for 20 years, so we're kindred spirits there. So yeah, if you can actually create some kind of disturbance outside of the interview, that'd be awesome, because I can always use the sound.
Well, we'll see if Luis Gourmet's MRI comes back bad. There'll be a lot of screaming from here. But yeah, you know, you really need to put your ego aside, because there are no credits on the front or the back. You never hear, you know, when a segment goes well, it's like, oh my God, that Rock segment was awesome, or that, you know, Jericho segment was awesome. They don't say like, oh, the blank name of the writer segment really killed it. When a segment goes south, you know, there's the online reaction, of course, but even internally, it's like Vince wants to see you at gorilla position, you know, the backstage area right before you go through the curtain. You know, occasionally the talent too, but there's a lot of pressure on you to deliver, because you're only as good as your last show. So you really don't have the ability to be like riding high. There's so many times I could point out like the high of a previous show and then failing spectacularly the next week, or when we were going to Raw and SmackDown back to back, literally the next day. You know, you really can't get too high. And you also have to be, okay with failure, because there's just so much content. You know, 2-3 hour show on Monday, 2 hour show on Friday, which is, you know, when I was there, it was taped on Tuesdays, 3 hour pay-per-view the day before. So many characters, sometimes something hits, sometimes stuff doesn't. You know, you really can't get too high or too low, you know, because there's just the need to do a show every single week. There's no repeats. There's no, you know, off season. There's no hiatus. You know, it's just on every single week. So you have to be relentless. You have to be creative. You don't have time for burnout, as weird as that sounds, you know, because it would seem like it would be just something that you can't avoid. And then occasionally it does come up, But, you know, when you're in the grind, when you're in the thick of it, it's just like onto the next show, onto the next show, and not, you know, getting your hopes up when the 8:30 in the morning Emmy nominations come out sometime in July, because you're not going to be on it.
You mentioned that you mentioned about the grind, and for people who are not, and there certainly will be people who listen to this podcast who are not wrestling fans. I understand that. WWE is a 52 weeks a year product. You go to different cities. There are, let's say, between 60 and 100 characters. The writers have to know, if they're good, the history of the backstories that can go back decades. You were a writer's assistant on a Nancy Travis show. You were a writer on Jenny, which starred Jenny McCarthy. I think you had another Hollywood credit. So you did, prior to joining WWE, you had worked in Hollywood for a couple of years. What were the similarities between writing for a sitcom and writing for WWE, if there were similarities?
Well, by the way, there were two other credits, very esteemed shows. One of them being Claude's Crib on the USA Network, and the other one being Big Wolf on Campus on Fox Family, which actually had multiple seasons. It was kind of like it was supposed to be like a Buffy light, you know, kind of thing back in the...
Who is the lead? Who starred in that? Who was the main star of that?
The Wolf. You know, yeah. I didn't really get to know the Wolf. I wasn't, you know, it's funny. They shot it in Canada, so we'd write all the shows in L.A., but then they'd go off to write it in Canada. I could frantically, since this is a podcast, go on IMDb. But he did do other things. I remember he did do, several people from that cast went on to do.
Right. All right. So this wasn't like David Boreanaz before, let's say, he became like some, you know.
No.
Main stars. One.
I'm going to look it up afterwards. I think.
It's fine.
Wolf did well for himself. But yeah, there were, you know, the similarities, you know, and it evolved really because there wasn't really a quote unquote writer's room when I started at WWE, because there was only two writers at the time. The closest thing to a writer's room was, you know, those Tuesday morning meetings in Vince's hotel suite when we would write SmackDown. And, you know, and the major difference being like on the Werewolf show, for instance, you know, we had several weeks, if not a couple months, to write the scripts, get them in order. When my writing partner and I were, you know, we wrote two episodes of that show. We went off to outline to write the outline first, and then go pour over the outline with the showrunner, and then write the script another week, a full week, you know, to write the script. Whereas, you know, for SmackDown, circa 1999, 2000, 2001, it was that morning you'd write the script and produce it, and it would air, you know, or at least go live to tape that day, airing a couple days later. So that was, you know, that was a major, major difference. You know, you still have to like pitch things and be vocal and kind of have to put your fear aside, of like, oh shoot, what if this bombs? What if no one likes this? What if it's, you know, if you're trying to be funny, what if nobody's laughing? You know, that's obviously prevalent in comedy writer room, but in WWE, you know, you're really pitching everything: matches, drama, backstage stuff, interviews, who goes over, i.e. who wins, who doesn't, where is this going? If someone asks you, okay, great, you want this guy to beat that guy, what are you going to do next week? I'm like, well, you could do this, this, or this. I'm like, okay, well, I don't like any of those things. What else you got? You know, there's a lot of variables. Obviously, huge difference, you know, with WWE is like, you know, the Jenny McCarthy and the cast of Jenny isn't touring around the country during the week, you know, but right before you do the TV taping. So you're not going to like get a call saying, hey, two of the co-stars injured themselves and are going to be out 6 to 8 weeks pending their MRI and x-rays. That variable happened. I mean, I remember like right when we were getting into the group of Evolution, which is Triple H's group, Triple H, Ric Flair, Batista, and Randy Orton. Batista and Orton got injured at a live event, and we had to completely scramble. You know, we heard about the injury over the weekend, and we had a show that Monday. So that aspect, you know, that's just, you know, unheard of, obviously, you know, for sitcoms and dramas. I mean, obviously, things can happen, which are rare as far as, you know, whatever afflictions occurring to a cast member, but not on a regular, they're not like putting their bodies on the line literally every single week, three shows, you know, Friday, Saturday, Sunday prior to the Monday TV show.
You know, I imagine that your answer here is going to be the same as well. You know, you wrote for Jenny, and obviously you're not Jenny McCarthy. But one of the things that, like, is always interesting to me, and let's take the case of Kurt Angle, who you wrote for many years. Kurt Angle has called you the best wrestling writer in history. He's obviously incredibly fond of you. You had a great relationship. For those who don't know, Kurt Angle, on top of obviously being one of the more famous WWE stars, was an Olympic gold medalist, like one of the great athletes in wrestling for his time. I think it's fair to say, Brian, that you two are very different. You know, he's an Olympic gold medalist, and you know, you were a Jewish kid who went to Syracuse at Newhouse. But yet you got him. Like, you were able to write for him, and it worked great on the screen. So again, this is sort of a larger kind of writing question. How does one write for someone who on face is so different than them?
You know, a lot of it is, it's a boon to have people to write for that you're so, that are so different from you. Because there's a lot of, you know, I forget what the term is. It's not hero placement, but it's something like I could never say, you know, let me backtrack. I would always kind of like use the measuring stick of a good character, especially like in the late 90s or what have you, as someone who, oh, I wish I could go back in high school and take this person's persona and steal it. With the assumption that back in, you know, late 80s, early 90s, no one knows who this person is, and just be the coolest person in the world. So if you could do that, if like I could all of a sudden transform myself into Stone Cold Steve Austin or The Rock or, you know, something like truly badass or even like a wise ass like Chris Jericho or even Kurt, you know, during certain phases of his career, that, you know, is a good character. If you say like, you know, I don't want to pick on any wrestler, but if you just take a wrestler and you can't imitate that person's voice, then that's probably a problem with that character. But you know, for people who are so much different than you, it's really kind of it's a great fantasy to be able to like, okay, I can't say this in real life, but I can imagine this, you know, I could have this person say all the things that I wish I could say if I was in that situation. So, you know, in the cases when I'd get into arguments with Vince, and Vince was a character on TV. It's like, I can't tell off Vince backstage, but I could have The Rock, you know, tell him off and say things that, you know, sometimes deep down I was feeling, but couldn't say, you know, exactly to his face and stuff. So it's, yeah, it's, you know, I'd imagine it's like writing for superheroes, really. It's like, you can't, I can't place myself as the mighty Thor or anything like that, but I'm sure it would be a hell of a lot of fun to try to write, you know, a Marvel or DC movie and have those heroes come to life, because it's what you've always wanted to be deep down and always wanted to do. And Kurt is actually, Kurt's kind of the exception, because unlike so many wrestlers, Kurt and I actually are, I would say, alike in some respects. From the, you know, Kurt is just like this, you know, at least when he started, it was this like nerdy guy who was tiptoeing into this world he really like didn't know much about. In fact, I knew a lot more about WWE than Kurt did, because I had watched it for, you know, almost two decades before I started, whereas Kurt, you know, was so focused on his amateur career, he hadn't really started watching it until a couple of years earlier. So yeah, it's great. Wish fulfillment, is that it? I don't know, but
yeah that's it.
It's great to be able to be like, oh my god, like a wrestler based on my own persona it would be very, very boring and very, very beatable. But I could put words in the Rock, you know, persona like that. That is awesome.
Did you, you've obviously now worked with Dwayne Johnson for a long time, your professional colleagues, your friends. Did you find, in the same way that you had with Kurt Angle, were there similarities to the two of you where you can find that world? Or is he truly like the opposite, like the, you know, the different id for you, where you were just like writing for a superhero character in this sense?
I mean, a little bit of both. You know, with Rock, we are basically the same age. He's a year older than me. You know, we in fact, he went to Miami, obviously.
Right.
Played football there. And I, you know, in hindsight, I didn't realize it obviously at the time, but I booed the loving shit out of him and all his teammates. You know, when Miami would come to the Carrier Dome, there was one particular game I remember freshman year. So his sophomore year, but really his first year playing because he got hurt freshman year, where we were stopped on like the 3 yard line. We came within 3 yards of beating Miami. And I remember, and they were all celebrating on the field and like kind of like taunting the fans and everything. And I remember, I'm not really a loud booer. I'm not I usually just, you know, keep it all in, but I remember booing the holy hell out of the Canes that night. But yeah, it's like we are very different, obviously. But also we kind of have the same sense of humor. And we also grew up in the same time. So we both have the same influences as far as 80s movies and cartoons and all that kind of thing, you know, like as from our childhood. I was a very different childhood too. I like grew up on Long Island. You know, I think my family moved from one, you know, a place in Limbrook, a place to Woodmere when I was 4 years old and stayed there ever since. Whereas Dwayne, you know, had dozens of different homes. That's kind of like the whole, that's how we kind of got around to Young Rock is like every time we go to a different town and put a promo together, he'd like, oh, you know, I lived here back in 1988. Like, what? But you said you lived in, oh yeah, I lived there too. So he was just all over the place. But yeah, there's like the stuff that he brings to the table, you know, he brings from a very unique perspective of his own. Stuff I bring to the table is unique to me as well. And there's a lot of stuff that overlap, even though, you know, on the surface and everything. Yeah, physically, athletically, you know, you couldn't be more different. But yeah, he's like a very humble, down-to-earth guy who grew up in the 80s, idolized Harrison Ford and Star Wars and Indiana Jones, you know, loves Clint Eastwood, like all the stuff. There's so many just, you know, pop culture things that we're on the same level with, and you know, love a good insult and as well as far as, you know, his promos and everything, that really meshed together pretty well.
I'll do one more sort of this process stuff, and then I'll do a couple things from the book. If you in the book, you talked about that for anybody listening here who's young and is a fan of pro wrestling, let's say wanted to write for it, you believe, you know, as the expression goes in the wrestling world, product knowledge is obviously important. To be a fan, as you have said, it would be very hard to write for pro wrestling if you were not a fan. You would have to just essentially catch up on so much stuff. It would make the writing harder. That said, in my world, you know, when you think about like if you wanted to become a sports writer, you know, you would put together like a clip package, your resume, and you would, if you didn't have a word of mouth or networking contact, you would sometimes just cold resume like to some newspaper or magazine you loved and hope that, you know, maybe someone would read your stuff and you'd get a call. Is it possible to almost do that with like the WWE or AEW where you would send to their human resources person or sent to someone who's a executive there, like almost write a treatment or write like a scripted storyline scenario? Like, could that work? Or is this world now where they're so big, there's so much money floating in that they're going to try to recruit Hollywood writers the way, you know, you sort of ultimately came in?
No, it works both ways. And obviously, too, like, as you know, like they didn't recruit me.
No, you're if you read the book in Brian's, he's sort of like they were desperate for writers at that time. And he had been brought in once before. So he was a little bit of a known quantity. But I think, Brian, you would even admit this in many ways, like sort of fortune hit you in terms of timing in that they desperately need you. You proved yourself and then you became an invaluable part of the machine.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And they do recruiting as well. But they also they post jobs on I forget exactly which websites. I think like for a while it was Hot Jobs. I don't know if that's still a thing that they do, but I do know like
it's like Nikon.com or something.
Yeah. Well, there's a process where they, you know, they kind of put it out there like and they give you, you know, the, you know, parameters of which to submit something. They want you to have some samples. And what a sample, I think, at least was when I was there, was some sample storylines to do, like something that would play out over a month, let's say 3-4 weeks. And, you know, what you would do with established character and that type of thing. You don't need to write a full television script. You don't have to do seg one, this person faces this person. But like, okay, here's a story of, you know, Randy Orton versus Grimace from McDonald's. I'll just come up with that.
I would love
an event in any arena across the country. You know, and in week one, this would happen. And then week two, Grimace would get his heat back and go to, you know, stalk Randy Orton in the thing. So yeah, they want to see, you know, at least when I was there, like you have not only product knowledge, but how to apply that product knowledge and come up with something compelling and something that's interesting that hasn't been done before. And yeah, you know, I would say the ratio of success at WWE, from a writing standpoint, almost, I wouldn't say almost all of it, but definitely over 60% of it, of the people who've come and gone there who have been successful have come in internally, either as a writer's assistant or as someone who like started at a lower level, then worked their way up. You know, most of the people who are brought in, you know, with big Hollywood credits and everything, you know, with some exceptions, haven't had that product knowledge. So they're behind the eight ball right away. They're not like, again, it's a different story now with SmackDown being live on Fridays, but back then, Monday, Tuesday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, you know, the travel is just like a wallop to, you know, a shock to the system. Like, wait a minute, it's 11:15, 11:30 at night. And now we're going to drive, you know, 200 miles to the next town in the cold, you know, that type of thing. You know, this is in some cases, you know, when I was there, this was even before GPS and that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's like it is a shock to the system. But, you know, being able to be comfortable, but not like a giant fan freaking out and, you know, talking about like, oh, there's Matt Hardy. He was, you know, he had this match in 1992 against someone, you know, and just, you know, losing your shit because you see a wrestler. You know, that's a detriment, but knowing, you know, the character's history and what they're capable of is obviously a big, you know, big advantage.
All right. So let me sort of make sure I can sort of phrase this right. There have been a lot of wrestling books, as you know, Brian, where there are people who are like, we're not happy with their career and they will just basically do a tell all on how things were horrible for them. There are other books that are very celebratory of the subject, you know, like I don't even want to mention any wrestler's name, but, you know, whatever. They're, you know, they're putting themselves over in the parlance of wrestling, that like sort of like they're, you know, if they were screwed, it was the other people screwing them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. One of the reasons I really liked your book is because you let us inside behind the scenes, like in things like Wrestling Court or how you first met Roddy Piper and worked for him and sort of the behind the scenes of Roddy. I thought that like the most where you really went in depth, sort of gave us some behind the scenes stuff, is the relationship between John Cena and The Rock and how the promos that they went against each other sort of crossed over into some real life heat. And this was really revolving around the idea of John Cena making comments initially that Dwayne Johnson wasn't really all in on WWE, if he's sort of going to Hollywood and then occasionally coming back. You can read the book and you'll find all this out. My long filibuster here is that you made an interesting choice as a writer to let us in behind the scenes, but you didn't you didn't bury anybody. And you, in many ways, are very self-deprecating and I think self-aware of your own role in some of this stuff. So I guess I just want to ask you, like, why did the decision to write the book as you did? And if you can be candid, did you run some things by some people to make sure that they were comfortable putting it out there? Because you clearly didn't go in saying, I'm burning the place down and this is my, you know, here's why WWE is horrible thing. I found it really interesting just the way you wrote the book. And so I wanted to get some insight into how you approached it.
No, thanks. Yeah. I mean, look, the truth is I wanted to go into this book not from a I'm going to bury someone perspective or I'm going to put myself over perspective, but from an honest perspective. And from like an honest point of view, I, for the most part, had a pretty good time when I was there. I did not get along with everybody. I got along with a lot of people. I had some really great times. I had some extraordinarily frustrating times. And I just wanted to, like, you know, just tell it. And I think, you know, the books that influenced me, the wrestling books, were, you know, Mick Foley's, Chris Jericho's. They were able to, like, when you read their books, you're like, wow, this person is not putting on a gloss or a coat of paint. They're telling an honest story, but it's also not like this bitter trip down, like this person then screwed me and I didn't, you know, this person took my spot or whatever it is. Like you, and maybe some people might not respond to that because they're accustomed to the burial book. I don't know if anyone's really accustomed to the, you know, put yourself over for 280 page book.
Yeah. It's a lot.
Yeah. But yeah, I just wanted to be able to tell it from, you know, from a real perspective, like, hey, this is there are times I was frustrated. There are times I was happy and elated. There are times where I thought I was losing my mind, but here it is, warts and all. And yeah, there were a couple of, you know, I cite it in the book. There's a, you know, Michael Cole, you know, I was like, are you cool if I sell the story? He's like, yeah, man, go for it. Like Michael Hayes, for instance, the Freebird, Michael Hayes.
Yeah.
Always had this attitude of like, yeah, tell whatever the fuck you want. I don't care. I'm still going to be over. You know, like there's nothing that can faze him. That being said, I sent Michael a book. He texted me. I sent a text from Michael Hayes. I'm like, oh boy. And he's like, got the book. Thanks. I'm like, okay, good, good. I thought, you know, for a second, you know, what the fuck are you doing talking about me in the XFL? You know, like that kind of thing. But he's always been, you know, Michael's Michael. He's like, yeah, that this is who I am. It led to a very, very, you know, successful and lucrative podcast career for Bruce Pritchard telling Michael Hayes stories. So that's all good. And then some people, like in the case of like John Cena and Paul Heyman, I didn't really, you know, and again, I don't want, I like both of those guys. I don't want to have any kind of, you know, kind of burial type mindset from certainly from anyone reading it. But I wanted to tell like, you know, the truth of what my experience was at least. And I did tell them after the fact. So I saw them right before I went to Australia for season two of Young Rock. John was at an MSG live event for WWE. Paul was obviously there. And I told him about the book and I told him like, oh, I tell the story of when we were rivals on head writers for Raw and SmackDown. And I told John about like, I got into a chapter about the whole WrestleMania thing. The fact that we're in a really, really good place now, you know, definitely helps with that. Because if there's like lingering heat, then it's kind of raised eyebrow. Wait a minute. What exactly did you say? Like the fact that like, you know, we're really, really cool. And, you know, really even during our time there was cool. It was just like going, you know, going into the trenches and you kind of like, it's like, I said it was once, it was like The Wire. It's like, this is the game. You know what the game is. So yeah, I told John and Paul, you know, last September about this book coming out and they know me. And then there's like a certain level of trust. They know that this isn't going to be like a burn it all down type of book, that it's going to be like the funny stories and the crazy stories. And the this is not particularly believable, but I swear this happened type stories. Yeah, so for the most part. And then there were a couple times I went to... I sent chapters of the Edge and Christian Wrestlers Court to Edge and Christian ahead of time, just in a, am I leaving anything out? Or is this is the way it happened, right? You know, and they, you know, I was happy that it was accurate, but, you know, I was, of course, at the time, so focused on myself that I had forgotten a lot of their antics. So, you know, Christian, Jay, was like, oh, you know, we had a fake book with our pictures on. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. You know, and Edge Adam was telling me, yeah, and you know, we paid Undertaker off afterwards with you know, some liquor and everything. I'm like, oh, thank you. Yes. So that was very helpful as far as fact checking and, you know, making sure it was accurate as possible.
Maybe you've already heard from some of the principals, but do you care or is it important to you how the top people at WWE perceive this book or reacted to this book?
Yeah, I haven't really gotten, you know, it hasn't, you know, it officially comes out this week. And I don't know, you know, I don't know what the specific, you know, reaction to things. I think it will go over well because it really is a celebration of,
you know, I would agree with that.
My company and my time at the company and, you know, that whole era anyway. It isn't like, you know, again, I don't really have any interest. It's just not my style to be like, you know, burning bridges and everything else. But also not to do this rose colored, you know, fantasy either, you know, so I think they'll appreciate that. And I think, you know, when they read it, they'll like it because again, you know, I mentioned this once before, like when I started, that movie Beyond the Mat had come out, and, you know, it's a great film and it's really, really, you know, takes you backstage. But I remember the WWE reaction to it. This, again, I had just started when it came out, was, man, we gave them all that access and they paint us so dark and gloomy and kind of a downtrodden place to work. Whereas, you know, it's really kind of, it is sometimes just a live action Muppet show backstage, with people running around and hair, wardrobe, props, like everything you could, you know, that goes into putting a live show. And it really, you know, that movie didn't necessarily capture the spirit of that. It did a little bit, but its focus was elsewhere. And I wanted to capture the spirit of that. And I think it did. So I think they'd be happy with it.
Okay. Picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I want to get to the XFL before we get out of here, just because as a sports media podcast, I think my listeners will be fascinated by this. But this, you have gotten some kind of questions around this, and this is going to come up, especially as you do publicity. So as we tape this, people know that Vince McMahon has left WWE. According to the Wall Street Journal, other reports, he made about $20 million in undisclosed payments and unrecorded expenses that led to his exit in the company. There's been a lot of talk, obviously, about what those payments were for, including perhaps hush money to people to sort of not disclose relationships between, obviously, Vince McMahon and others in the company, for the sake of letting people know where things stand. The WWE board is currently overseeing an independent investigation of the previous payments and allegations. This, getting to you, Brian, is this is not something that you would have anticipated having to be asked about during your book publicity tour. But because it's such a WWE heavy book, I wanted to know, if does it change the promotion for what you're doing at all? And what are your feelings now on the fact that Vince McMahon, such a central figure in your book and such a central figure in your life, is no longer at the head of the company?
Well, obviously, yeah, it changes, you know, from a company standpoint, it changes everything. The guy who was in charge for so many years, you know, for a lifetime, really, you know, now being gone. I mean, from my perspective, from the book perspectives, you know, specifically from a book perspective, it doesn't really change anything, because, you know, my relationship with Vince and my story and everything that I experienced from my perspective really doesn't have, you know, doesn't intersect with that and doesn't have anything to do with that. You know, so from that perspective, it's just like, yeah, here's the experience that I went through from my POV, and it's in the book. And yeah, a lot of things, you know, I talk in the end of the book about, you know, seeing Vince at, you know, live events or Raw or SmackDown tapings when I go backstage. And he's no longer there. So from I you know, you can't anticipate, you know, anything that seismic happening like that. So in some respects, it's you know, when people, you know, will read that, they'll definitely be a light bulb over their heads going, ah, yes, a lot has changed since then, in such a short amount of time. And it's, you know, it's obviously it's hard to really even process all the gigantic changes that the company, you know, is now going to be going through. You know, it's also pretty exciting from the perspective of, okay, where do they go from here and what happens now? And you see it kind of on the shows, as far as like released talent being brought back and yeah. NXT favorites who, obviously, I don't think Vince had the bandwidth to watch NXT and really get to know those talents. And so it would be like, that's NXT. This is WWE. Let's start over. And that doomed a lot of NXT talents from the get go. And now, you know, with Triple H being so, Paul Levesque being so ingrained in NXT and knowing those characters, you know, you see a vast difference as far as like how they're presented, and hence the show benefits from that perspective. So yeah, like the short answer of it is, I don't think it really, you know, from my perspective, because this book is from my POV and my relationship and everything, I don't think it really affects it. Obviously in the real world and the show and what the company's dealing with, you know, the events of the past month have had gigantic seismic implications and changes and everything else. But you know, it's basically, you know, again, just from my perspective, two different tracks.
Last one on this. You were there, you're in the middle of all this. Do the allegations change your perception of Vince? How do you just process the, what's been alleged, and the person that you worked with for nearly 15, 20 years?
Yeah. I mean, it will, you know, it can't not, you can't just be like, on the one hand, you can't be like, oh, well, it's Vince being Vince. You know, it's like, that's kind of a cold way of looking at it, especially with real people affected. You know, on the other hand, you know, on the flip side, there's a lot of stuff that still need, you know, information and everything that needs to come out and needs to be fully explained in terms of what happened. But yeah, I mean, you can't, you know, from the boss perspective at WWE, nothing really changes again, because from my perspective, that was our relationship. From a, you know, but open your eyes and look at what's happening in the real world perspective. Yeah, it's, you know, you kind of want to see all the information come out and see how everything unfolds. But I definitely have opinions on it. I mean, I don't necessarily want to get into it specifically, but you know, like I'm a, you know, like every human being, you see, you know, the news and you process it and you definitely have opinions on it. And it's going to be, I mean, look, it's going to be pretty fascinating to, you know, what transpires over the next year or so.
I appreciate your answering that. It's not easy questions for you. I understand that. Let's get to the XFL. I was fascinated by your chapters on the XFL. And let me just be blunt. It honestly comes off like a shit show. Like, it's unbelievable. Like, that thing, you even got off the ground. So you're there. Dick Ebersol, very famous figure in my world. You know, produced Saturday Night Live. But beyond that, was the head of NBC Sports forever. What were those productions meetings like? You're not, I mean, you know, you signed up to be a wrestling person.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't sign up to be a football production expert. And then, like, there's these crazy, like, promos that, like, with the players and the cheerleaders. I mean, could you just give my listeners some insight into, like, what was it like being there? Because, man, it comes off, like, just crazy, basically.
It was surreal. And it was probably the most intense week. It was only a week that I was on the ground there. But it felt much, much longer. Because, yeah, myself, Michael Hayes, and Bruce Pritchard were brought in to work on the XFL in addition to our WWE duties, because obviously, as you know, WWE didn't go away during, you know, February 2001. We still had shows to do. In fact, very important shows to do, because it was the lead up to WrestleMania 17, The Rock versus Austin, you know, culminating with Austin's heel turn. So there was like this was like super, super important WWE, you know, time period right now. And WCW had just been bought or close to it. And there was like all this stuff. But yeah, we were sucked in. And it was pretty fascinating to kind of be a fly on the wall and see, you know, the WWE way of doing television production, mixing with the NBC way of doing television production, and Ebersol and Vince being two, you know, extraordinarily alpha figures. But they're also very good friends. So like they did mesh, but there was the football perspective of it. And then there was also Vince's perspective of it, which was this, you know, as Bob Costas might say, not enough WWE for WWE fans and not enough football for football fans. But, you know, he wanted to get that, like, unlike the XFL, like current version, like he wanted to take on the NFL. and he had Tony Siragusa on the sidelines bashing him. And he had, like, you know, the No Fun League and like that kind of thing, kind of, because that was, you know, kind of prevalent in the WWE at that time, which was like a fuck you attitude to everybody that wasn't WWE. So he definitely wanted, like, and that's the reason why I got sucked in, was to do these vignettes, you know, with the cheerleaders and the football players. You know, Vince actively, you know, his perspective on it was like, in all likelihood, the players and the cheerleaders are going to date anyway. So why not capture the relationship between them? So if something happens on the field, good or bad, you know, it's kind of like, I remember, you know, as growing up as a Mets fan and everything in the 80s, there was like a, all of a sudden someone flipped the switch, and maybe it happened before then, and I was just a kid and never noticed it. But I just remember, like, there were always like Gary Carter's up at the plate. They're cutting to Gary Carter's wife in the stands, and Lenny Dykstra's wife, and like all the players' wives all of a sudden had a camera always focused on them when their spouse was up to get the reaction shot. And I think, like, Vince being Vince wanted to, like, all right, let's take that. And how could we take it to the next level? Like, right. We know they're dating, and but she's a cheerleader. And we also do these vignettes introducing them because, you know, they're not, they weren't blind to the fact that they knew that, like, nobody would know who these players are. That's why I don't know if anyone knows He Hates Me's real name, but they all know he hate me, you know, because Vince, like, yeah, but they want to put a nickname or they want to put a phrase or whatever on the back of their jersey, let them. NFL's not going to let them do that, but we are. I mean, there were so many great, like, and there were great innovations with, you know, this jib camera that they ended up using in the NFL too. You know, there were so many individual great ideas that were kind of like emerged from what was, yes, a giant shit show. You can't deny that. I think, you know, in the end of the day, the football play, it probably went on because they wanted a debut right after the Super Bowl. Where's my football? You know, that was what Vince was saying in the promos and everything and the press conferences, that they went on without necessarily being ready yet. I thought, yeah, when I got there to Vegas to watch, like, the Vegas Outlaws practice right before opening weekend, you know, I write about it in the book too. I thought it had a very Jurassic Park vibe to it. I felt like Jeff Goldblum walking around right before, right as John Hammond is giving him the tour. Anybody think this shouldn't necessarily happen yet? But it did.
Yeah, there were some football innovations where they were ahead of their time. And then, yeah, as my buddy Conrad Thompson would say, there's some things you watch there that don't exactly play well in 2022.
Sure.
But that was the XFL. All right, I'm going to keep you for another, like, 6 minutes, and then I'll get you out of here. I was blown away, or I have been blown away, by how many current people in the business have put out your book on social, like Becky Lynch, Natalya, Alexa Bliss. I'm guessing if you got some good publicists and a smart book company, they're sending copies in advance there. But, you know, you I know you still have your connection with Dwayne, obviously, but have you – you must be – I don't, maybe pleasantly surprised is not the right word, but you must be really happy to see the current performers, or at least a number of current performers – who are helping you pitch your book. Like, they're really into this, even though, you know, you're not at their company.
Yeah, right, no, I'm thrilled and super grateful too. You know, I again, like, you know, Dwayne goes back occasionally, and when he does, I go back with him. So when he last came back, this was the premiere of SmackDown on Fox a few years ago. And we did a promo segment, The Rock did a promo segment with Becky Lynch and Baron Corbin.
That's right.
And that's when we really got to know Becky, and we worked with her, you know, and the night before, and worked on the promo and got to be friends with her. And always, you know, whenever I go back to a show, always want to say hi to Becky. You know, Zelina Vega, I sent a copy to. We worked with her on Fighting With My Family. She played AJ Lee in the movie. And yeah, we got to work with her and get to know her there. You know, Alexa Bliss and, you know, there's a whole bunch of current stars that, you know, I always go out of my way to find and say hi to whenever, I'm at a show backstage. And there's, like, a lot of, you know, I was there doing creative consultant from 2012 to 2015. And some of those people overlapped, you know, like Seth Rollins, for instance, yeah, right, who's married to Becky. You know, he seconded Becky's tweet. Yep. He wrote on Twitter because the book was in the house and he read it too. So I was, yeah, over the moon by that. because, you know, I'm a huge fan of his, and he's such a great performer, and he didn't have to do that, but he did. But yeah, like I, you know, there are plenty of current wrestlers that, you know, that I reached out to and said, hey, I'd love to send you a copy of the book. And if you like it, feel free to put it over. No pressure, do it or not do it. But what's your address? Let me send it to you, because, you know, just, I know from experience that there's going to be a lot of, you know, nodding while reading it, going, oh yeah, yeah, I know what he's talking about. I think they can appreciate a right. lot of the things, but also appreciate this. A lot of these current stars, you know, it's crazy to think about, but we're kids, you know, when I started, I feel like 90 years old now, but like, I don't know. I'm not even sure what year a lot of the stars were born in, but I know in 1999, they weren't adults. You know, they were kids going to the shows, watching these angles growing up. So I think there's like a little bit of like, oh yeah, I was, you know, a fan just like you were, right? You know, in the 80s, I was during your era in writing. So, you know, it works out.
I like Rollins a lot. He's been on this podcast, and I should have mentioned to you at the top, like Paul Heyman's been on this podcast maybe 5 or 6 times. He's like my Charles Grodin of the wrestling world. He's the he's in that chair, and he's always good. I'm definitely a Heyman mark. I have to cop to it. Brian, correct me if I'm wrong here. I feel like when I was just reading all my sort of research on you, have you floated a couple lines to AEW over the years? Like, is that correct, or am I? Did I dream this?
No, literally a couple. Dream. You know, okay. Yeah, I've always maintained a great friendship with Jericho. You know, he called me a couple times. You know, and I threw stuff out at him. You know, and he even called me out one time because he asked me about something, and I'm like, well, I'm in Australia, you know, for Young Rock. I haven't been able to watch the show, and he's like, yeah, but you have a fucking computer, don't you? Just watch the damn thing, you know. And that, you know, I'm like, well, I can't argue with that. You're right. So yeah, there are a couple of, you know, I kind of remember. I don't remember specifically what the lines were, but I'm always, you know, I love, you know, if a wrestler calls me asking for like a line, like, hey, I'd love to help.
I would, yeah. Take advantage of that that free service. All right. So the reason I ask that is because I think MJF's a brilliant performer. His promos are unbelievable. You are probably in the, you know, 1% of the world who could actually offer some insight into this. Like, you're, to me, genius level at this stuff. I no longer can figure out if it's a work or if he's really in a dispute. And I give everybody credit for that, because at one time I was thinking, all right, this is absolutely a work between Tony and MJF. Then I'm like, you know what? This is a real contract dispute, and this guy is done. Now I don't even know. Do you have any, given your expertise, how do you view that situation?
Well, look, I'm a big MJF fan as well. You know, we both have, you know, the whole Jewish from Long Island.
That's right.
Fan.
That's right.
Thing yeah. in common. I'm happy to say I got to meet him once. And I think he's a really, really cool guy. You know, I saw the promo, and like everyone else, it's like, oh, this is a work. Clearly they wouldn't let you say that if it wasn't a work. And right. then, you know, he goes radio silent. And not only that, but the company is, you know, treating it as if, you know, AEW is responding to his promo as if it was a shoot, and he's persona non grata on the website, on their television show, on their social media, on everything else. So, you know, in this particular case, like, I don't even want to overstep my bounds and text him and be like, hey, so what's really going on? Because I'm sure there's a reason for everything, whether it's a shoot reason, whether it's a work reason. But this is too good to just like almost want to be spoiled by what the hell is actually going on. I just want to see it unfold myself. But it was, I think, a masterclass. The fact that people don't know, the fact that so much has happened in the world of worked shoots and shoot works and everything else over the years, where you really go, well, what could possibly surprise you now? And you have to assume it's a blank. And this one, you really can't. Like, look, you're no, you know, like not, you're savvy to the business. Obviously you've talked to wrestlers, you've talked to people behind the scenes, and you don't know what's going on. So I would,
I do not.
So I would say, like, yeah, that's like they've done a master class, MJF specifically, in making you wonder, because every day that goes by, it lends validity to, I guess it was a shoot. And every day that goes by where AEW doesn't even acknowledge what was their their number one homegrown star, makes you wonder. So I don't know what the hell's going on, but I think it's really, really cool that something like that could kind of capture fans' minds now in a way that you never thought was possible.
If you're in the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale marketplace where each piece is carefully vetted and verified by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. If you're in the market, use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
All right, two more quick ones and lay out of here. Let me just mention the book again. There's just one problem. True Tales from the former one-time seventh most powerful person in the WWE. Just basically Google that on or send that into Amazon and you can buy it there. I imagine it'll be in bookstores around the country. Hopefully Brian will get to do some in-person book signing stuff, because hopefully, things get better with COVID, actually people will be able to go to bookstores and see authors, which is always an amazing thing. Brian, how do you feel? I talk to obviously a lot of real, quote unquote, real announcers, the Joe Bucks and Troy Aikmans of the world. Wrestling has a very, very famous history of involving their announcers in storyline, including them taking like bumps and getting dropped on their head and other crazy stuff like that. How do you feel about that? Did you like getting Jim Ross or Michael Cole? McAfee is like all over the place now. So like conceptually, do you like that? Or were you on the side of let the announcers be the announcers, don't involve them in storyline?
Well, it's twofold. First of all, McAfee is, example of doing it the right way. As far as someone who's a former athlete and can, not only handle himself in a match, but excel in a match. And I was always a big fan of Jesse Ventura growing up. And it was always kind of special whenever, he rarely, as an announcer, he rarely got involved physically. But whenever like a wrestler announcer would take off the headset and, insert himself into the action, it was always a special time. I think, as far as using like JR and Michael Cole, in physical things, I think at the time it was, we did it because we knew it would, be an easy pop, an easy reaction. JR was, such a sympathetic character, and they're the closest characters to you, because a wrestler might be on 10 minutes on a 2-hour show. The announcers are on the entire time, 100%. There's never a time where they're not on, unless it's an angle or something like that. So in hindsight, I think it was cheap and easy for us to use, JR for sympathy angles, for like, oh, let's get heat on JR. That will always get a pop, like that kind of thing. And Stone Cold can make the save, like whatever babyface was going to make the save for him. Or we really want Triple H to get heat. Well, if he beats a Mick JR bleed at Madison Square Garden, that ought to do it. Right. And it's really, you know that like JR and Michael Cole are pros. They'll do whatever's asked of them. I think like when you're caught up and like you want to have a great segment, you want to like get a big pop and everything. And the opposite for Cole, because Cole went the heel route. And, that became Vince's obsession for a while. Heel Michael Cole the point where it's hard to, it's really, really. Saying something for Cole to be able to, just one day flip the switch and turn on and be a heel after being like this neutral guy all his life. And then similarly, when that angle was done with Lawler and Cena and the match at WrestleMania and barbecue sauce and all that kind of stuff, to then flip the switch and go back to being neutral and no longer insulting Daniel Bryan and everything. In hindsight, 100% hindsight, I don't think we should have done it as much as we did it. I think we overdid it. I think it wasn't really necessarily fair to JR and Cole, even though they always did it, you know, and never, you know, tried to get out of it or anything like that. I think Vince had he had this very unique relationship with Jim, which Jim has written about very successfully two books. So it might have gone a little bit more than, you know, from my perspective, either getting heat on a heel or a pop from babyface. I think the McAfee route, and hopefully Corey Graves, I don't know, you know, if he, you know, gets medically cleared and never wants to go, you know, he'd be a great guy to do that too, because they know what they're doing out there and that's what they trained for and live for. Cole and JR, I mean, there's a lot of individual great moments, like the XFL, like a lot of things. But I think it was a crutch that we overused.
Last one. Sort of the history of wrestling is that everybody comes back. By the way, I'm proud of myself being the only podcast. I'm not going to ask you about The Rock coming back to WrestleMania. The history of the business is that everybody comes back at some point, not necessarily to the same company, but they come back. Do you think you have a very successful career now, obviously, with at your production company? Young Rock is a hit, and congratulations on that. Do you think there's any part of you that would want to come back for a week or two just to write? I know if Dwayne is involved, you'll be writing, and maybe that satisfies whatever that gene is. But I understand it. Like I'm as someone who's read and listened to so many podcasts in the business, I really agree with all the people who say there's nothing like the rush you could get from going out in front of 20,000 people. And if I was writing this stuff, there's probably is very few things in the world that are a bigger rush than an audience reacting to a line that you wrote. Like, you can't get that in a sitcom, because like unless the audience is there live, like maybe you get that. But if the audience isn't there live, you're just hoping like that the critics respond great. So for you, like, do you think that you'll ever just want to go back to the arena even for a little bit? Because you can't really duplicate, I would imagine, the rush of a live crowd at, like, Madison Square Garden or, you know, the biggest arena in Los Angeles, like, reacting to something that you
wrote. Yeah. And by the way, I don't know what they call Staples now either.
I know. I my brain was working. I was going to say crypto, whatever, but I don't even know the place anymore.
But you know what? I know it sounds like a cop-out answer, but when The Rock goes back, that does scratch that itch. You know, all of a sudden, you know, you're not only are you writing for WWE when The Rock comes back and he's, you know, kind enough to want me to come with him and, you know, we go to the shows and put up the hotel and all that kind of thing. But the stakes aren't higher because The Rock's not doing like a lower card angle. If he's doing something, that's going to be the thing on the show. So that definitely scratches that itch. Outside of that, if Rock all of a sudden, you know, was approached by space aliens and said, I'm going to be leaving this planet now, and there was no chance of him ever going back to WWE. I don't know if I would necessarily like have this itch, because I haven't been away from it that long. You know, I've only been away from it, you know, full time, completely away from it for 7 years, and had been in it for 16. So it's not like, you know, so much time has passed, especially with Rock coming back, do the angle with Becky. And, you know, since I've, you know, left several WrestleManias and, you know, and that kind of thing. So yeah, like I've always had the advantage, I guess, of like, if there was a show at MSG or in Brooklyn, I could always go back and, you know, maybe like I'll find Miz and maybe like, hey, what, let's work on your promo individually. Yeah. What the hell? Nobody's going to say, no, wait a second. You don't have an ID. Get out of here. You know, they'll always be very forthcoming and open and that kind of thing. But no, I think it's going to take at least the amount of time I spent in WWE to equal that outside of WWE. And at that point I'll be so, out of it and not like, you know, be like, I don't know, making all these 80s and 90s references and the people of 2033 looking at me like, what is this guy talking about? I don't know how effective it will be, but yeah, I mean, I don't really have that desire now. But who knows? Maybe one day it will come back. And I also know the break glass of in case of emergency, Rock coming back, you better be ready to do it because it's going to happen.
Listen, Brian, I reached out to you, whatever it was, in March and April telling you I really wanted to talk to you. It wasn't bullshit. Like, I could talk to you for another like 5 hours. I think your background is just incredibly fascinating, especially given the career that I'm in. I'm really rooting for this book to do well. And so let me put you over once again. Brian Gerwerz is an executive producer for NBC's Young Rock. That's part of his role as a senior vice president of development at Seven Bucks Productions. That, as I have said before, is the production company co-founded by Dwayne Johnson and his producing partner, Danny Garcia. If you don't know who Dwayne Johnson is, I can't help you at this point. Brian's book is There's Just One Problem, True Tales from the Former One-Time Seventh Most Powerful Person in WWE. I think it officially comes out. Is it August 16th?
August 16th, yeah.
Okay, all right. So we're taping it the week it comes out. I have no doubt it's going to get a lot of attention. Brian will do much bigger podcasts and forums than this one for sure. Brian, listen, man, you gave me an hour. I really, really appreciate it. My only hope is that in some of the questions I asked you, that will help you in future interviews as you sort of hear yourself answer these questions. But I really seriously, in all sincerity, I wish you the best of luck with the book. I respect how much passion and how much love you put into the book. It's very, very clear as you read it. So thanks so much for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast, and best of luck with this.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, people can't see it, but I've been appreciatively nodding for like the past 30 seconds. So thank you and appreciate all the kind words. And I had a lot of fun talking to you. So, and let's do it again sometime too. Let me try to equal, I don't know if I could be Charles Grodin, but I could at least be, Al Roker or something, and, come by more often.
You have the invite. And there'll be no snooker coconut on your head either.
Fair enough.
We'll make this good. Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Richard.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Brian Gerwerz for giving me as much time as he did. We went pretty long. I could have talked for much longer. Again, I find that intersection of writing for wrestling and just how one goes about it, how one looks at it, the fact that you got to know all these backstories. It's just really interesting to me as a writer to see how these skilled professionals do that. So I thank Brian for his time, and I wish him the best of luck with his book. The podcast before this one was a conversation with Jason Reed, who's a senior NFL writer for ESPN's Zanscape. He has a new book, The Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America. Did a podcast on Brittany Griner and what happens next with her with a hostage policy expert, Dr. Danny Gilbert, and ESPN investigative reporter TJ Quinn, who's been following this podcast. Joe Buck on Vince Scully was the podcast before that. Also had Ian Dark come on talking about he'll be calling World Cup games for Fox later this year. Head to the archives. There should be some stuff that's of interest to you, particularly if you like sports media. Not too long ago, a 63-minute conversation with ESPN chairman Jimmy Pitaro on where that company is going. If you like this stuff, please leave us a review. 5 stars is always great, and a nice note really helps things continue. I want to thank Patrick Antonetti for all his hard work, doing a lot of hard work this week on this podcast. It's greatly appreciated. Thanks to everybody at Canes 13, and thank you for listening. We'll see you soon on the Sports Media Podcast.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League Podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.